A new relationship show aired last month for the first time. I don't know if you caught it. It's called Married at First Sight. It's the latest in a long list of relationship shows. The premise is that four couples meet for the first time at the wedding altar. Now, due to Australian marriage laws, they can't officially get married, but they have a commitment ceremony after which the cameras follow them around for a month or so to see if they can make it stick. So what do we think about that kind of idea? A couple of shaking heads, couple of raised eyebrows. This idea of a modern day arranged marriage. Did you know that traditionally, marriage has been seen as more of a type of business deal? You see, historically, you got married to a person who would help your family's station in life. You would pick a person who has the right social standing or the right amount of money. More traditional cultures today still do the same thing. You see, the honour of the family and the well-being of your family is more important than your personal preferences in a prospective spouse. Now, the Western view of marriage is a bit more tailored to our individualism, isn't it? Marriage in the West flows out of romantic love. You know, do I find this person attractive? Can I love this person? Can I spend the rest of my life with this person? They're the kind of questions we often ask in the West. The Bible says that our Western view of marriage is actually just as wrong as the traditional view of marriage. While romantic love is important, I don't want to discount the importance of romantic love, our passage today declares that there's something of greater importance. And as such, if we start a marriage or run a marriage based on romantic love, we're actually heading towards danger. So if you thought that Ephesians 5, 21 to 33 is controversial because of what it says about male headship, all right, you ain't seen nothing yet. The real controversy of this passage is that it shows that our Western view of marriage is terribly limited. And those limitations are actually holding Western Christians back from enjoying marriage. And can I say singleness as well, marriage and singleness, the way God intended them to be enjoyed? That's what we're looking at today. Now, much of what we're going to be looking at today comes from this book that I've read recently. It's by Tim Keller and his wife, Kathy, called The Meaning of Marriage. It has had a profound effect on me in the last 2 weeks. And if what we talk about today sparks any of your interest, can I highly recommend getting a copy of this book. But with that in mind, let's dive in and have a look at marriage. Now, if you've got your Pew Bibles open there, page 1820, you'll notice that our passage begins with a heading, Instructions for Christian Households. But what we need to realise is that verse 21 in the Greek is not actually a new sentence. It's part of a sentence that Paul began up in verse 18, which is actually over the page. He says this, chapter 5, verse 18, do not get drunk on wine, which leads to debauchery. Instead, be filled with the Spirit. And Paul then goes on to give various descriptions of what a Spirit-filled life looks like. So, speaking to one another with psalms, hymns, spiritual songs. Singing and making music from your heart to God. Always giving thanks to God. And then when we get to verse 21, the Spirit-filled life is submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. That's what Christians do. We submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. But what does that mean? What does it mean to submit? Well, the Greek word, hupotasso, literally means to place yourself under another. That's what submitting means. So in the army, for example, the soldier would submit, would place himself under his commanding officer. He would listen to the authority of his commanding officer. That's what submitting means. Now, you need to note, though, that the commanding officer is not a better person than the soldier. He just has a different role. In Philippians 2, the Apostle Paul says, in humility, consider others better than yourself. Now, he's not saying, look, try and really believe that everyone else in the world is better than you in every way. All right, that's not realistic. What he's saying is we should act. We should act as though the fulfillment and the satisfaction of other people is more important than our fulfillment and satisfaction. That's what submitting to one another means. And the reason a spirit-filled person can actually serve others is because they have the gospel sitting at their very heart. You see, the gospel says two very important things. To begin with, it says we are way more sinful than we can possibly ever think. So sinful are we that the only way God could save us from our sin was to have the Son of God die for us. But the gospel also says we are way more loved than we ever dared imagine. Because the Son of God willingly died for us. Now, friends, we need both those statements. If you ever have a sermon, hear a sermon that misses out one of those statements, they haven't preached the gospel properly. All right? We are thoroughly sinful, yet thoroughly loved. So how do these two gospel truths lead Christians to always be serving? Well, it's because these two truths remove self-centeredness and self-neediness. Okay? So it removes self-centeredness because when Christians realize just how sinful they actually are, we stop demanding that others serve us because we know we don't actually deserve it. But the gospel also removes self-neediness because when Christians realize that we have been given everything, everything in Christ, well, we're no longer driven by a need for a lot of thanks or by a need for a lot of feedback or a lot of payback. All right? And because spirit-filled people don't need anything, they're always serving. Spirit-filled people submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Well, in verses 22 to 25, Paul then begins to outline what it looks like when two spirit-filled people get married. And as you can imagine, a spirit-filled marriage is one that sees both parties serving the other. But God tells us that husbands and wives have particular ways in which they are to serve the other. So, for example, verse 22, wives are to submit to their husbands. Okay? So the way wives consider their husbands as more important than themselves is to willingly give leadership in the marriage over to the husband. Husbands, in verse 25, are to love their wives. Okay, so the way a husband considers their wife as more important than themselves is to place the needs of the wife ahead of his own. Now, do you see the beauty of a spirit-filled marriage? All right, you see, when two people who are filled with the Spirit, who are driven by the gospel, get married, their marriage becomes a competition to see which partner can outdo the other in loving and serving the other. They both say to each other, look, your need to thrive in life is more important to me than my need to thrive. And so I'm going to do everything I can to make sure you do thrive. And can I say that this includes letting your spouse love you? All right. If their goal in life is to love and serve you and you're always refusing to let them because you're the one that needs to do the serving, what are you actually doing? You're actually blocking their goal in life. Okay, love means letting the other serve you sometimes. But the thing I want to note about spirit-filled marriage, and it was picked up at the beginning, is that it only works if both parties are filled with the Spirit. All right, Ephesians 5:21 says, Christians, if you are a Christian, do not marry a non-Christian. They will not and they cannot submit to you out of reverence for the Lord. Ladies, it is very hard to submit to a man who has not had his heart reshaped by the gospel. And I would say the same for men. A spirit-filled marriage is one where both parties are filled with the Spirit. But what does this look like? Well, let's have a look at quickly at men and women. Paul goes for ladies first, so we'll look at that. What does it mean for wives to submit to their husbands? I'll make a few quick comments, beginning with what submission is not. Okay, submission is not sitting there quietly with your mouth shut. All right, a godly husband will want to love and serve his wife, and so he will want to hear what that should look like. Okay? A spirit-filled marriage is one where they communicate, both parties, always. Submission is not forced. It must be offered. You see, as soon as compliance is demanded by a husband, it becomes subservience, not submission. Thirdly, submission is not putting up with abuse. While some corners of the church have sadly, called wives to remain in the family home with an abusive husband, that's not actually submission. That's allowing someone to continue to sin against you. Friends, if a husband is trying to control his wife, whether it be physically, emotionally, sexually, or financially, the wife should get out, at least until the husband is seeking help and changing. Friends, submission means letting the husband take the lead. Okay? Now, one of the main ways this pops up is when a couple comes to an impasse. So like I said, a spirit-filled marriage is one where the husband and the wife talk about every major decision, right? Figuring it out themselves. But the thing about marriage is there's only two votes, isn't there? And if those two votes are different, God has called wives to let the husband make the decision. Now, sadly, there's a tendency among some today to think that male headship somehow reduces a woman's dignity or strength. Yet when we look to Jesus, we see that the opposite is actually the case. Okay? In Philippians chapter 2, we are told that Jesus chose to submit to the Father's will, even though the Father's will was to kill him. All right, understand this. God said to Jesus, "Submit to me, and I will kill you." Yet because Jesus said, "Your will be done," he has now been elevated to the highest place. So when a wife submits to her husband, I mean, Kathy Keller puts it this way. She says the wife is playing the Jesus role in her marriage. Playing the Jesus role. And that cannot be an assault on her dignity, because it wasn't on Jesus. You see, when a wife submits to her husband, she is displaying the same kind of greatness that Jesus himself showed. Well, that's wives. They are submit to their husband. What are husbands to do? Sorry, I forgot to mention at the beginning, we'll have a question time at the end of this. I should have mentioned that earlier, but if there are things that I have said that aren't quite lining up, there'll be time for questions after. In verses 25 to 33, we come to the husband's role, and we are told that husbands, there it is, love your wives. But I'm going to be honest with you, it'd be foolish to think that what we hear and read in verses 25 to 33 don't also apply to wives. Do you think husbands are the only ones that are to love in a marriage relationship? Of course not. Wives need to love their husbands as well. So what we're looking at here is for both spouses. But the reason that Paul directs these commands at husbands is because he is declaring that husbands are to take the lead in this. That's what leadership looks like. It means being the first to do something, taking the lead. So men, can I say, if your wife is better at loving you than you are at loving her, then you're actually failing in your God-given role as head of the household. So guys, listen up. This is specifically for us. Verse 25. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Now, this verse brings us to the very heart of this passage. All right, if you want to understand the Bible's teaching on marriage, how to have a happy marriage, who to marry, how to conduct said marriage, this is it. Paul says that Christian marriages are to emulate Christ's relationship to the church. And he says it even more forcefully down in verse 31 and 32. Have a look. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. Now, the word mystery there refers to this huge secret, a huge secret that has now been revealed to the world. Now, that's what the word mystery means in the Bible. It's a secret that's been revealed. And this particular secret says that God's desire for marriage is that it reflect or emulate or copy the way Jesus relates to the church. So if we want to know why the Western view of marriage is wrong, right? If we want to know why the Bible's view of marriage is better, we need to look at how Jesus relates to the church. Now, this is the pivot on which this whole topic hangs. And we see that in verses 26 and 27. So at the end of verse 25, Christ gave himself up for the church to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church, without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. So understand this. Jesus looked down from heaven on the church, and he saw creatures who are but a shadow of who we're supposed to be. Right? We are marred by sin. We are ruined by the fall. We are damaged as image bearers. And Jesus said, I want to help them. And so he went to the cross. And if we embrace Jesus, we are made holy. We're cleansed from our sin. But you know the awesome thing about this passage is Jesus, it tells us Jesus was not happy just to pardon us. He went even further. You see, too many Christians today think that salvation is the end of Jesus' work. It's rubbish. That's the beginning. It's only the beginning. You see, Jesus wants to make us better. The descriptions in verses 27 refer to the last day, where Jesus' disciples will have all their sin and all their guilt fall off them. And they will stand there, we will stand there, perfect and radiant, like a wife on her wedding day. And this is what Jesus is doing for the church. This is what he's done. He has seen our potential. This is what Jesus did. He looked at our potential. He sees what we can become. And he says, through my blood and through my spirit and through the power, my service and through the power of my spirit, I want to help you get there. Right, that's how Jesus runs his marriage. He didn't marry the church to improve his station in life. If anything, it brought it back. And he didn't marry the church out of romantic love. We hated him. You see, Jesus married the church to help us reach our potential. And that is what the Bible says a spirit-filled marriage should look like. So what are the implications of this? Friends, the first is we need to realize that marriage is not the greatest thing in the world. Western culture has this tendency to idolize marriage. It says, look, if I just find the right person, and if that person can just make me happy, then life will be worth it. The problem with that mentality is that it can only end in disaster, because no human can bear the burden of godhood. You see, if you expect your spouse, a mere human, to be able to fill you up and make you happy in the way only God can, two things are going to happen. Number one, you are going to crush this poor person under your godly expectations of them. And number two, you'll become miserable in the process because they're not meeting your expectations. Friends, implication number one is that even the best marriage on the planet is still pointing to something beyond itself, and that is the spousal love of Jesus. Do not crush your spouse by demanding they give you the love and fulfillment that only Jesus can. Implication number two is for those of us who are not too happy about being single. Okay, this is for the single people. It's not just the married people who idolize marriage. Single people can sometimes think for themselves, if only I was married, then that'd be enough. For the single people, can I say, marriage does not fill your heart. Marriage does not fix your problems. Now, I'm not saying marriage is terrible and that you should run from it, but what I'm saying is that as great as marriage is, there is only one spouse who can truly love you and fulfill your dreams and aspirations. And that spouse is waiting for you right now. If only you would make him your ultimate treasure. Implication number three is probably for our kids, our teenage kids, who hopefully have Jesus as their ultimate treasure, but they are hoping to get married. There might be some here today as well, hoping to get married. Here's the question: what kind of person should I marry? You see, Western society tells us we find someone who is beautiful, who is successful, who will help us reach our financial goals, and who is compatible. That's actually code for they'll take me as I am. They'll accept me as I am. Right? This passage says the almost exact opposite. The way a Christian is to choose a spouse is to be looking at their spiritual potential, looking at what Jesus is doing in their life right now as he draws them towards that final day when all their ugliness and all their guilt and their sin will just fall off and they will become everything they can be. Right? That's the kind of person we should be choosing as a Christian, someone who is growing in their Christian maturity. Implication number four is for those among us who might be experiencing marital problems right now. You might find yourself saying things like, if only my spouse were giving me what I wanted. To you, this passage says, the spouse you need is available right now. And he can give you everything you need and want. And if you look to Jesus to fill you up, you can actually handle your troubled marriage way better than you might be at the moment. Because you no longer need your spouse to fill you up. You're no longer saying, if only my spouse would give me this. You're actually getting it all from Jesus. The true spouse. The best spouse. And if you are being filled up with Jesus, that means that you can continue loving your spouse unconditionally. Just as Jesus is loving you. Fifth and final implication is how we run a spirit-filled marriage. And that is to place the fulfillment of your spouse ahead of your own. In particular, their spiritual fulfillment. All right? So we are to get up every morning and ask ourselves, what can I do today to help my spouse find satisfaction? What can I do today to help fulfill my spouse's aspirations and dreams in life? And most importantly, what can I do today to help my spouse become more like Jesus? More like Jesus. And you know, the beauty of placing your spouse's spiritual growth of first importance, well, under Jesus, of course, Jesus, then your spouse's spiritual growth, is that you get to be married to someone who is more like Jesus. And that can only be a good thing. You see, the more like Jesus they become, the more they will want to fulfill your dreams and aspirations in life, and the more they will want to help you head towards your goal of spiritual maturity. You see, Ephesians 5:21 is not just the key to a successful marriage, it's the key to the happiest marriage there is, which is where both people are becoming more and more like Jesus. So friends, the mystery, the secret of a successful and happy marriage is not romantic love. Yeah, that's got to be in there, but that's not number one. Number one is to do for our spouse what Jesus is doing for us. Husbands, you've got to take the lead in this. Got to. Wives, don't wait around for him to. Just jump in and follow Christ, who loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present to her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. Okay. Any questions? Nick, take it away. So you have to speak up, the air conditioning is making it hard. Yes? Yep. Yep. Okay, so I think Nick's question is just a little hard to hear, but Nick's talking about idolatry. It's one of the biggest issues in our life when we take a good thing, like marriage, or like work, or like sex, or like money, and we turn it into an ultimate thing. And there are implications for that. Like, God has been knocked off his perch as number one, where he should be, and we've put something else there. Now, so is your question, how can we, like, if we see this in those around us, is that what you're saying? Yep. Okay, so how do we point out to someone their idolatry? That is a really hard thing to do. It's the same as pointing out someone's sin. That's not an easy thing to do. Okay, I don't think I've ever done it well. I'm still learning in how to do that. But if we don't at least try, we're leaving people in their idolatry, and what that leads to is disaster. You see, when you get your loves out of order, everything falls over. So I read an example in Keller's book about if we place our job as more important than anything else. And what actually happens is, like, it's like, let's just say your job is more important than your actual physical health. And he's picking up that passage where it says, who has ever not loved their body and looked after their body, right? It's actually in the passage. And he's saying, if you love your job so much that you don't even look after your physical health, guess what happens? Your job suffers in the long run. Okay? So there's real implications for having your loves out of order. How do you show someone? It's got to be in love. I think you start with prayer and you pray hard for that person. And I think you need to have some sort of relationship with that person to be able to do it. And you need to be able to sit down and just... Look, I think you need to be able to do it in as gentle a way as you can to sort of just point out or ask them questions. They're like, are you placing too much priority on this thing here? Do you actually love Jesus as number one, or are other things getting that role in life? It's really hard, brother. Do you want to come back to me on that? Yep. It is. Yep. You're not loving. Yeah. And that's right. And look, Steve picked up on it. I think it was last week's sermon. He says, if you're on the receiving end of a rebuke, okay, don't be the kind of person that shuts that off. That's really bad. All right? Take what they're saying on board, go away and think prayerfully about it. And if they're a loving Christian friend, they're not doing it because they want to hurt you. They're doing it because they love you. And if it is done in love, you know, you should take it in love. So I agree that if you leave someone in their idolatry, it is not loving, but it needs a lot of prayer because it's hard to get it right. It's hard to get it right. Yeah. Another question. Peter Ross.
Some men, the two easiest words to say are yes, dear.
Yes.
And we make jokes about
Okay, so Peter's question is, what would I say to those husbands who are not natural born leaders, who, like me, have married someone a lot smarter than them, a lot more organised than them, and they're just happy to say, yes, dear, and let the wife take the lead? I think that is a recipe for disaster, to be honest. And it's only because the Bible tells us that's not the way it's supposed to be. So I don't just have examples to go on. I have the Bible to go on. And so what I would say to husbands is, that's your job. That's how God made you. God made you to lead your family in all ways. Now, that does not mean that you don't listen to your wife. All right? You listen to your wife and you figure out together what the right way ahead is. And usually the decision you make is the decision that will best serve your wife and your family. But I would say man up. That's what I would say. Man up and fulfill your God-given role as a man in the household. Do not... Yeah, if you're leaving the leadership to the wife, you're going against what God has told us to do. Yeah, that's what I'd say. In a loving way, of course. Dave Power. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Dave's question is, what happens when your two votes are different and neither wants to budge on their decision, basically? Now, you're right, submission cannot be forced. As soon as you're forcing someone, it becomes subservience. Reality of life, though, is that we cannot control the other person. We can only control ourselves. And so there's only you can only make the decision as the head of the household if you are being allowed to make the decision as the head of the household. And that's what I would say early on. Make sure you're marrying a spirit-filled person who, as a wife, will let you make the decision, and as a husband, will make the decision for you, like in the most loving way possible. But there will be times and marriages where the other person will not submit. And that's difficult. That's difficult because you can't control the other person. All you can do is continue to love them the best way you can. And that may mean that for the sake of the marriage, you can't make a decision. It's a sad, sad state to be in, and it's difficult, and it'll take a lot of prayer and a lot of grace and patience. But because we can't control the other person, not much we can do in those really difficult situations. I think, is that what you're getting at, though? Yeah, I think so. So if the wife says, no, there's no way in the world I'm letting you make this decision, not a lot you can do other than love them as best as you can. But you want to be making decisions that will benefit them. Ian, did you want to follow up on that or a new one? Yeah. 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 That is always the answer, Ian. Always keep doing what Jesus does. But that is a good parallel to say that Jesus' agenda for us is to make us more and more holy. And we don't always work in conformity with that agenda. But that doesn't stop Jesus still loving us and wanting to make us and working to make us more and more holy. So, yeah, you do your best to love. Yeah. How are we doing for time? I think we got time for maybe one or two more. Ruth. Go. Yep. Yep.
So in a marriage where I
Mm. Mm. Yeah, yeah, good point. So Ruth is talking about the vertical relationship versus the horizontal relationships. Do we only get filled up by Jesus? And the answer is no. And we see that in Genesis chapter 2, where, is it chapter 1 or 2? One of them. Where there is something in creation that's not good. And the thing that's not good is that the man is alone. We are made in God's image. And part of that image means we are made for relationships. And when God saw that Adam had no other human relationships, he said, there's something not good here. I want to fix that not good thing by bringing along Eve. And so I would say that Ruth is right, that we can and should look for satisfaction in horizontal relationships. We cannot, though, elevate that to the number one. Our number one is always Jesus, and our love tank should never be empty if we have Jesus. There should always be things that are overflowing. But we do need relationships from those around us to keep us sane. Like people in solitary confinement often lose their sanity because they're not living the way they should be living with people around them, loving, relating, and supporting them. So I would agree with that, yeah. One more, Mark. Go on. So are you talking about wives submitting? Okay. Yep. Okay, so... Okay, so Mark's question, which is based around abuse, I take it, or when things go wrong, how much of our culture, I don't know if I'm going to word this right, but how do we take the culture of the first century when this was written into account with our current modern day culture? I think we always need to be looking at the different cultures, particularly our culture versus the first century culture, and see what the differences are. But I actually think there's a lot more correlation in the commands that Jesus gives than differences. Because the commands that Jesus gives us are how we're to live in this world. And the way God designed this world doesn't change, right? The laws of physics don't change. The laws of morality don't change. God's laws, therefore, don't change. I mean, they're perfectly timeless in that way. But they are given in historical and cultural contexts. In terms of, though, with how a husband and a wife are to relate, with the husband as the head and the wife submitting to his authority, his leadership, I don't think that changes I don't think it should have changed in any way, shape or form. I would have thought that wives in the first century should be communicating with their husbands and saying, this is what I think our family really needs, the same as it does today. I think our culture has changed a lot in terms of spousal abuse. We're a lot more open about it today, not open enough, but we're a lot more open to it. But I would say that spousal abuse is always wrong, and that's actually why God gives us caveats in the Bible for divorce. And there's actually a caveat in the Bible in the Old Testament. So this is going back 5,000 years for spousal abuse. In Exodus 21, it says that if you do not give your wife food, clothing, and conjugal love, okay, she's free to leave. That's Exodus 21. It's an amazing little passage. So in terms of spousal abuse, nothing has changed in 5,000 years. Have I hammered your question, though? Is that what you're getting at? I don't know if I fully understood it. Okay. Cool. I think it's probably time. So I'm going to hand back to Steve.